Slide 5, The Boat of a Million Years, by Paul Anderson, continuing on page 127. "What?" he exclaimed, sitting straight in his astonishment. "You let me rattle on and on about what you perfectly well knew. Men must show forth their cleverness." Cadog whooped laughter. "Superb! A girl who can lead me, by the nose like that is the girl I can stay with forever." He sobered. "But now we'll make the move as soon as may be. At once, if I have my wish, out of this filth, to the first true home we've either of us had since—" She laid fingers across his lips. "Hush, beloved," she said low. "If only that could be. But we can't simply disappear." "Why not?" She sighed. "It would rouse too much heed. A search for me, at least. There are men, highly placed men, who care for me, who'd be afraid I'd met with foul play. If, then, we were tracked down—" "No." A small fist clenched. "We must go on with our pretenses. For another month, perhaps, while I prepare the ground with talk of, oh, making a pilgrimage, something like that." A little while passed before he could say, "Well, a month, set against centuries. For me, the longest month I ever knew. But we'll see each other during it often, won't we? Say we will." "Of course. I will hate making you pay, but you can see I must. Never mind, the money will be ours once we are free. We do need to lay plans, make arrangements. Let that wait till next time. This while we have today is so short. Then I must make ready for the next man." He bit his lip. "You cannot tell him you've fallen sick?" "I'd best not. He's among the most important of them all. His good will can spell the difference between life and death. Bardas Manassas, a Manglebites on the staff of the Archistrategos." "Yes, someone that high in the military. Yes, I understand." "Oh, my dearest, inwardly you bleed." Athenaeus embraced him. "Stop. Forget everything but the two of us. We still have an hour in paradise." She was wholly as knowing, as endlessly various and arousing as men said. 3. A miniature procession crossed the bridge over the Horn and approached the Blakerny gate. There were 4 Rusi, 2 Northmen, and a couple in the lead who were neither. The Rusi carried a chest that was plainly heavy, suspended on 2 poles. The Northmen were off-duty members of the Varangian Guard, helmed and mailed, axes on their shoulders. Though it was clear that they were earning some extra pay by shepherding a valuable freight, it was also clear that this was with official permission, and the sentries waved the party through. They went on by streets under the city wall. Heights soared above them to battlements and heaven. The morning was yet young, and shadow lay deep, almost chill after the brightness on the water. Mansions of the wealthy fell behind, and the men entered the humbler, busier Fanar quarter. "This be muckwit," grumbled Rufus in Latin. "You've even sold your ship, haven't you? At a loss, I'll bet, so fast you got rid of everything." "Turned it into gold, gems, portable wealth," Cadog corrected merrily. He used the same language. While he had no reason to distrust their escort, caution was alloyed with his spirit. "We're leaving in another pair of weeks. Or had you forgotten? Meanwhile, though, meanwhile it'll be stored safely, secretly, where we can claim it at any hour of the day or night, and no beforehand notice. You've been too much sulking when you weren't off bowsing, old fellow. Have you never listened to me? Aliat arranged this. What did she tell their high and mightinesses to make the way so smooth for us?" Cadog grinned. "That I let slip to her, what a glorious deal I stand to make with certain other high and mightinesses, a deal which these men can have a slice of if they help me. Women, too, can learn how to cope with the world." Rufus grunted. The building in which Petros Simonides, jeweler, lived and had his shop was unprepossessing. However, Cadog had long had some knowledge of what trade went through it, besides the owner's overt business. Several members of the imperial court found it sufficiently useful that the authorities turned a blind eye. Petros received his visitors jovially. A pair of toughs, whom he called nephews, though they resembled him not in the least, helped bring the chest to the cellar and stow it behind a false panel. Money passed. Cadog declined hospitality on the grounds of haste, and led his own followers back to the street.
"Well, Arnulf, Sviatopolk, all of you, my thanks," he said. "You may go where you like now. You will remember your orders about keeping silence. That need not keep you from drinking my health and fortune."
He dispensed a second purseful. The sailors and soldiers departed gleefully.
"You didn't think Petros' food and wine be good?" asked Rufus.
"They doubtless are," said Cadog. "But I really have need to hurry. Athenaeus keeps this whole afternoon for me, and first I want to get myself well prepared at the baths."
"Huh! Like this whole while since you met her. Never seen you lovesick before. You could as well be 15.
"I feel reborn," said Cadog softly. His vision dwelt on distances beyond the bustle and narrowness around.
"You will, too, when we found you your true wife. With my luck, she'll be a sow."
Cadog laughed, clapped Rufus on the back, and slipped a besant into his single palm.
"Go drown that gloom of yours, or better yet, work it off with a lively wench."
"Thanks." Rufus showed no change of mood. "You do toss money these days." "A strange thing about pure joy," Cadog murmured. "One wants to share it." He sauntered off, whistling. Rufus stood with hunched shoulders and stared after him. 4. Stars and a gibbous moon gave light enough. The streets, gone mostly quiet, were swept clean. Occasionally a patrol marched by, lantern glows shimmering on metal, embodiment of that power which held the city at peace. A man could walk easy. Cadog drank deep of the night air. Heat had yielded to mildness, and smoke, dust, stenches, pungencies lain down to rest. As he neared the Contoscarion, he caught a ghost of tar on the breeze and smiled. How smells could rouse memories! A galley lay at the Egyptian harbor of Sor, weathered and salt-streaked by fabulous seas, and his father towered over him, holding his hand. He raised that same hand to his nostrils. The hair on it tickled his lip. A scent like jasmine. Aliat's perfume. And was there still some of her own sweetness? That had been such a long farewell kiss. And so happily weary. He chuckled. When he arrived, she told him a message had come from the great Bardas Manassas. He was unable to visit her this evening as planned. She and her dearest had that added time as a free gift of Aphrodite. "I have discovered what immortal strength means," she purred at the last, close against his breast. He yawned. Sleep would be very welcome, if only it were at her side. But her servants already saw how she favored this foreigner. Best not give them further cause for wonderment. Gossip might reach the wrong ears. Soon, though, soon. Abruptly, darkness deepened. He had turned into a lesser street near the harbor and his lodging. Brick walls hulked on either side, leaving just a strip of sky overhead. He slowed, careful lest he stumble on something. Silence had also grown thick. Were those footfalls behind him? It crossed his mind that he had several times glimpsed the same figure in a hooded cloak. Bound the same way by mere chance? Light gleamed. A lantern uncovered in an alley as he passed it. For an instant he was dazzled. "That's him!" struck through. Three men came out of the gut into the street. A sword slipped free. Cadog sprang backward. The men deployed, right, left, in front. They had him boxed, up against the opposite wall. His knife jumped forth. Two of the attackers were armed like him. He wasted no breath in protest or scream for help. If he couldn't save himself, he'd be dead in minutes. His left hand ripped his mantle loose from its brooch. The swordsman swung back to strike. The lantern, set down at the alley mouth, made him a featureless piece of night, but Cadog saw light ripple along his hip. He was mail-clad. The steel whirred. Cadog swayed aside. He snapped the mantle at the unseen face. It drew a curse and tangled the weapon. Cadog leaped right. He hoped to dodge past the foeman there. That wight was too skillful.
His bulk stepped in the way, his dagger thrust. Kadag would have taken it in the belly had he possessed less than immortal vigor. He parried with his own knife and retreated. Bricks gritted against his shoulder blades. He was trapped anyhow. He showed teeth and fainted, side to side. The dagger men prowled beyond his reach. The swordsman prepared to hew afresh. Sandals thudded on stones. Light glimmered on a coppery beard. Rufus' hook caught the swordsman's throat. It went in. Rufus worked it savagely. The man dropped his blade, clawed at the shaft, went to his knees. He croaked through the blood. Kadag scrambled, snatched up the sword, bounced back erect. He was no grand master of this weapon, but he had tried to acquire every fighting art that the centuries brought. A knife man scuttered clear. Kadag whirled in time to smite the second, who was nearly at his back. The blade struck an arm. Through the heavy impact, Kadag thought he felt bone give. The man shrieked, stumbled, and fled. Snarling, Rufus pulled his hook out and went for the first stabber. That one vanished, too, down the street and into night. Rufus halted. He turned about. "You hurt?" he panted. "No." Kadag was as breathless. His heart banged. Yet his mind had gone wholly cold and clear like ice afloat in the sea off Thule. He glanced at the mailed man, who writhed and moaned and bubbled blood. "Let's go, before somebody comes." He discarded the telltale sword. "To the inn?" "No." Kadag trotted away. His wind returned to him. His pulse slowed. "They knew me. Therefore they knew where to wait and must know where I'm staying. Whoever sent them will want to try again. I guessed it might be a good idea to tail after and keep an eye on you. That'd be a pile of treasure you left with that Fenariot son of a pig." "I shouldn't pride myself on my wits," said Kadag bleakly. "You showed a barrelful more than I did." "Ha! You be in love. Worse than drunk. Where should we go? I suppose the main streets be safe. Maybe we can wake him at another inn. I've still got money on me if you don't." Kadag shook his head. They had emerged on a thoroughfare, bare and dim under the moon. "No, we'll slink about till sunrise, then mingle with people bound out of the city. Those can't have been common footpads, or even killers for hire. Armor, sword. At least one of them was an imperial soldier." 5. The Sevalod the Fat, who stood high among the Rus merchants, owned a house in St. Mamo. It was small, since he only used it when he was at Constantinople, but furnished with barbaric opulence, and during his stays a wanton or two. The servants were young kinsmen of his, whose loyalty could be relied on, and upstairs was a room whose existence was not obvious. He entered it near the close of day. Gray-shot, his beard fell to the paunch that swelled his embroidered robe. A fist clutched a jug. "I brought wine," he greeted. "Cheap stuff, but plenty. You will want plenty, and not care how fine it is. Here." He shoved it toward Kadag. The latter rose, paying it no heed. Rufus took it instead and upended it over his mouth. He had snored for hours while Kadag prowled to and fro between the barren walls, or stared out a window at the Golden Horn and the many-domed city beyond. "What have you found, Vsevolod Izyaslavev?" Kadag asked, tonelessly, in the same Russian. The merchant plumped his bottom down on the bed, which creaked. "Bad news," he rumbled. "I went to the shop of Petros Simonides and met guards posted. It cost me to get an honest answer out of them, and they don't know anything anyhow. But he is arrested for interrogation," they said. A sigh like a step wind. "If that is true, if they don't let him off, there goes the best smuggling outlet I ever had. Ah, merciful saints, help a poor old man earn the bread for his little wife and darling children. What about me?" "You understand, Kadag Reiseth. I dared not push too hard. I am not young like you. Courage has leaked out with youth and strength. Remember now the Lord, in these high days of your life, before age and woe come on you too. But I did talk with a captain in the city guard that I know. Yes, it is as you feared. They want you. He does not know just why, but spoke of a brawl near your rooming place and a man killed, which I knew already from you.
I thought as much, said Cadog. Thank you.
Rufus lowered the jug.
What do we do? He grated.
Best you stay here where you have sought refuge, the Sevalod replied. Before long I go home to Chernigov, you know. You can ride with me. The Greeks shall not know you in my ship. Maybe I disguise you as a beautiful Circassian slave girl, Rufus, huh?
He guffawed.
We don't have the cost of our passage, Cadog said. No matter. You are my friend, my brother in Christ. I trust you to pay me back later. 30% interest, agreed. And you tell me more about how you got into this trouble. That might forewarn me. Cadog nodded. Once we're outbound, I will.
Good.
The Sevalod's eyes flickered between his guests. I thought we would have a jolly time tonight. Get drunk. But you are not in the mood.
Yes, a terrible sorrow, all that money gone.
I will have your supper sent up. We shall meet tomorrow. God cheer your sleep.
He rose and lumbered out. The panel slid shut behind him. Constantinople was a blue shadow above golden shining water against golden red sunset. Dusk filled the room in St. Mamo like smoke. Cadog raised the wine jug, swallowed, set it down again.
You really going to tell him? Wondered Rufus.
Oh, no, not the truth.
Now they spoke Latin.
I'll invent a story that he'll believe and that will do him no harm. Something about an official who decided to get rid of me and seize my gold rather than wait for his share of the profit.
The swine could have been jealous of you, too, Rufus suggested. The Sevalod might know you were seeing that Athenaeus.
I have to make up a story in any case.
Cadog's voice cracked.
I can't understand what happened myself.
Huh? Why, plain's a wart on your thumper. The bitch put one of her customers onto it. Shut your mouth for A. They'd have gone after me next, and divvy your money. Maybe she's got a hold on a fellow high in the government, like something she knows about him. Or maybe he was just glad to oblige her and take his share. We was lucky and lived. But she's won. The hunt is out for us. If we want to stay alive, we won't come back for 20, 30 years.
Rufus took the wine and glugged.
Forget her.
Cadog's fist struck the wall. Plaster cracked and fell.
How could she? How? Ah, 'twas easy. You wove the snare for her.
Rufus patted Cadog's shoulder.
Don't feel bad. You'll swindle yourself another chest of gold inside a generation. Why?
Cadog leaned against the wall, face buried in arm. Rufus shrugged.
A whore be a whore.
No, but she, immortal. I offered her.
Cadog could not go on. Rufus' mouth drew tight, invisibly in the gloom.
You ought to could see. You can think better'n me when you put your mind to it. How long she been what she be? 400 years, you said? Well, now that be a lot of men. 1,000 a year? Maybe less these days, but likely more than that earlier. She told me she takes as much freedom from the life as she can. Shows you how fond she be of it. You know the sort of things a lot of fellows want from a whore. And all the times a girl gets roughed up or robbed or kicked out or knocked up and left to handle that however she can. Leave it on a trash heap, maybe? 400 years, Lugo. How do you suppose she feels about men? And she'd never have got to watch you growing old.
Chapter 8 Lady-in-Waiting. Rain fell throughout the day. It was very light, soundless, and lost itself in the mists that smoked over the ground, but it closed off the world like sleep. From the veranda, Okura looked across a garden whose stones and dwarf cypresses had gone dim. Water dripped off the shingles above her and filmed the whitewash of the enclosure wall. There, sight ended. Though the broad south gate stood open, she barely glimpsed the avenue outside, a puddle, a leafless cherry tree. Fog had taken away the minor palace beyond. All Heian-Kyo might never have been. She shivered and turned back toward her quarters.
The two or three servants whom she passed by were bulky in wadded garments. Her overlapping kimonos kept some warmth of her own, and the carefully matched winter colors preserved a forlorn elegance. Breath drifted ghostly. When she entered the mansion, twilight enfolded her. It was as if cold did also. Shutters and blinds could hold off wind, but dankness seeped through, and braziers availed little. Yet comfort of a sort awaited her. Masamichi had been kind enough to allot her a sleeping platform to herself in the west pavilion. Between the sliding screens that marked the room off, a pair of chests and a go table hunched on the floor. She had a fleeting fancy that they wished they could creep under the thick tatami that covered the platform. No one else was about, so its curtains were drawn back. By the flicker of a few tapers, futon and cushions lay as black lumps. She opened the cupboard where her koto stood. It was among the heirlooms not yet removed. Its name was Cuckoo Song. How right for such a day as this, she thought. The bird that is the inconstant lover, that can bear word between the living and the dead, that embodies the ineluctable passage of time. She had in mind a melody well liked when she was a girl. Afterwards, she had sometimes played it for her men, those two among her lovers whom she truly cared for. But no, she remembered that the instrument was now tuned for a winter mode. A maid came into the section, approached, bowed, and piped, "A messenger has arrived from the noble Lord Yasuhira, my lady." Her manner took it for granted. The liaison between Chikuzen no Okura, lady-in-waiting in the household of ex-emperor Tsuchimikado, and Nakahari no Yasuhira, until lately a minor counselor to self-proclaimed Emperor Gotoba, went back many years. Her own name for him was Miyuki, Deep Snow, because that had been his first excuse for staying the night with her. "Bring him." Okura's pulse quivered. The maid left. She returned as the courier showed himself on the veranda. With the light from outside at his back, Okura could not only see through the translucent blind that he was a boy. She made out that his brocade coat was dry, his white trousers hardly sullied. Besides wearing a straw cape, he must have gone on horseback. The least of smiles touched her lips. Deep Snow would preserve appearances until the end. Her smile died. The end was upon them both. With proper ritual, the messenger reached that which he carried under the blind to the maid and knelt, waiting for the reply. The maid brought the letter to Okura and went out. Okura released and unrolled it. Yasuhira had used a pale green paper tied to a willow switch. His calligraphy was less fine than erstwhile. He had grown far-sighted. "With dismay I learned that you have lost your position at court. I hoped the ex-emperor's consort would shelter you from the wrath that has fallen on your kinsman Chikuzen no Masamichi. What shall become of you, deprived of his protection, when I too am made well-nigh helpless? This is a sorrow such as only Du Fu could express. To my own poor attempt I add the wish that we may at least meet again soon. In the waning year my sleeves, which lay over yours, are wet as the earth, though the rain on them is salt from a sea of grief for you." His poetry was indeed not to be named with any line of the great Chinese master, Okura thought. Nevertheless, a desire for his presence struck with astonishing suddenness. She wondered why. Whatever ardor they once felt had long since cooled to friendship. She could not recall just when they had last shared a mattress. Well, seeing one another might strengthen them by the knowledge that each was not uniquely alone in misfortune. True, she had heard that the new military governor was confiscating thousands of estates from families who had supported the imperial cause. But that was a mere number, as unreal as the inner life of a peasant or laborer or dog. True, this house would be taken over by a follower of the Hojo clan. But to her it had simply meant lodging given her out of a sense of duty toward common ancestors. Her dismissal was the sword cut she actually felt. It lopped her from her world. Still, she would shortly have left in any case. Surely Yasuhiro's isolation was worse. Let them exchange what solace they could. One must cling to form, even in answering what she recognized as an appeal. Okura knelt silent, thinking, composing, deciding, before she called for a servant. "I will have a sprig of plum," she instructed. That should complement her reply more subtly than cherry. From her writing materials, she selected a sheet colored pearl gray. By the time she had the ink mixed, her words stood clear before her. They were only another poem. Blossoms grew fragrant, then faded and blew away, leaving bitter fruit. It fell, and on bare branches, twig calls to twig through the wind. He would understand and come. She prepared the package with the artistry it deserved and gave it to a maid to bring to the courier. He would fare swiftly across the city, but his master's ox-drawn carriage, the only suitable conveyance for a nobleman, would take the better part of an hour. Okura had time to prepare herself. Holding a taper close, she examined her face in a mirror. It had never been beautiful. Too thin, cheekbones too strong, eyes too wide, mouth too large. However, it was properly powdered, the brows well plucked, the cosmetic brows painted just sufficiently far up the forehead, the teeth duly blackened. Her figure also left much to be desired, more bosom and less hip than should be there. It did carry its clothing well. The silks flowed gracefully when she walked with the correct gait. Her hair redeemed many faults, a jet cataract trailing on the floor. Thereafter she ordered rice wine and cakes made ready. Her karma and Yasuhiro's could not be altogether bad, for she was alone with a few of the servants precisely now. Masamichi had taken his wife, two concubines, and children to settle in with a friend who offered them temporary shelter. Their private possessions were going along for storage. He had said Okura and hers could come too, but was noticeably relieved when she told him she had her own plans for the future. Well-bred, the family had never said anything unseemly about the men who called on her and sometimes spent the night. Nonetheless, the fact that somebody who mattered was bound to overhear things would have inhibited conversation on this day when, of all days, it must be either frank or useless. With the clepsydra taken away and the sun obscured, it was impossible to tell time. Okura guessed that Yasuhira's arrival occurred about midday, the hour of the horse. Because of the servants, she had one of them place her screen of state conveniently, and upon hearing his footsteps on the veranda, she knelt behind it. Also for his sake, she thought wryly. Their world falling to pieces around them, the old proprieties mattered perhaps more than ever. He and she spent a while in formalities and small talk. Thereupon she broke convention and pushed the screen aside. Once that would have implied lovemaking to come. Today, a poetic reference or two among the banalities had made it clear that such was the intent of neither. They only wished to speak freely. The maids Kodayu and Ukon might well be more taken aback by this than by any union of bodies so daylit blatant. They preserved blank deference and brought in the refreshment. Good girls, Okura thought, as they went away. What would become of them? Slightly surprised, she found herself wishing the new master would keep the staff on and treat them gently. She feared he would not, being the kind of creature he was. She and her visitors settled onto the floor, while Yasuhira courteously contemplated the floral pattern on his wine cup. She thought how he seemed to have aged overnight. He went gray years ago, but moon face, slit eyes, bud of a mouth, tiny tuft of beard, had remained as handsome as in his youth. Many a lady sighed and compared him to Genji, the shining prince of Murasaki's 200-year-old story. Today rain had streaked the powder and blurred the rouge, revealing darkened lower lids, blotchy, sallowness, deepened lines, and his shoulders were slumped. He had not lost the courtier grace with which, in due course, he sipped. "Ah," he murmured, "that is most welcome, Asagao." Morning glory, the name for her that he used in private. Savor, aroma, and warmth.
resplendent light. She was compelled to cap the literary allusion by saying, but not, I fear, everlasting fortune, and whetted that a little by adding, as for morning glory, at my age might not pine tree be better? He smiled. So I have kept some of my touch in guiding conversation. Shall we get unpleasant topics out of the way at once? Then we can discourse of former times and their joys. If we have the heart to. If you do, she meant. I never had any choice but to make myself strong. I had hoped the Lord Tsuchimikado would retain you. Under these circumstances, dismissal may be less than the worst thing that could happen to me, she said. He failed to completely hide puzzlement. She explained, without a family holding rice land, I would be scarcely more than a beggar, liking even a place of my own like this to retire to when off duty. The others would despise and soon abuse me.
Indeed?
Women are as cruel as men, Miyuki. He nibbled a cake. She realized that was cover for the collecting of his thoughts. At length he said, I must confess the knowledge of the situation made thin my expectations for you. Why so? She knew the answer perfectly well, but also knew that explaining to her would help him.
It is true that Lord Tsuchimikado stayed at peace during the uprising, he said, but if he did not work against the Hojo chieftains, neither did he assist them. Now I dare say he feels a need to curry favor, the more so because they may then make one of his line the next emperor when our present sovereign dies or abdicates. Ridding himself of every member of any family that was in revolt seems a trivial gesture. Just the same, it is a gesture, and Lord Tokifusa, whom they have set as military governor over Heian-kyo, will take due note of it. I wonder what sin in a past life caused Lord Gotoba to try to seize back the throne he had quitted, Okura mused. Ah, it was no madness. It was a noble effort that should have succeeded. Remember his brother, and then Emperor Juntoku, was with him in it, and so were not only families like ours and their followers, but soldiers of the Taira, who would fain avenge what the Minamoto did to their fathers, and many a monk also took up arms. A bleakness passed through Okura. She knew how the monks of Mount Hiei repeatedly descended on this city and terrorized it, not only by threats, but by beatings, killings, looting, burning. They came to enforce political decisions they wanted. But were they any better than the outright criminal gangs who effectively ruled over the entire western half of the capital? No. It must have been because of our own former sins that we failed, Yasuhira continued. How far have we fallen since the golden days? We might have won to an emperor who truly ruled. What do you mean? Asked Okura, sensing how he needed to express his bitterness. It erupted. Why, what has the emperor been for generations but a doll in the hands of the mighty, enthroned as a child, and made to step down and retire into a life of idleness when he reached manhood? And meanwhile the clans have made earth sodden with blood as they fought out who should name the shogun. He gulped for air and explicated in the same rush of words, the shogun is the military head in Kamakura, who is the real master of the empire, or who was. Today the Hojo have won the clan wars, and their shogun is himself a boy, another doll who says what their lords want him to say. He reined himself in and apologized. I beg Asagao's pardon. You must be shocked at my bluntness, and needlessly, for of course a woman cannot understand these things. Okura, who had kept her ears open and her mind awake amply long enough to know everything he had told her, replied, True, they are not for her. What I do understand is that you grieve over what we have lost. Poor Miyuki, what shall become of you? Somewhat calmed, Yasuhira said, I was in a better position to bargain for leniency than Masamichi or most others. Thus I have leave to occupy my mansion at Heian-kyo for a short time yet. After I must depart, it will be to a farm in the east, well beyond Issei, that I am allowed to keep. The tenants will support me and my remaining dependents. But in poverty, and so far away among rude country folk, it will be like passing over the edge of the world. He nodded. Often will my tears fall. Yet she could not readily follow his quotation, having had scant opportunity to practice spoken Chinese, but gathered that it was about maintaining a serene spirit in adversity. I hear there is a view of the sacred mountain Fuji, and I can take some books and my flute with me. Then you are not wholly destroyed. That is one bright dust mote in the dark air. What of you? What has happened to this household? Yesterday came the baron who will take possession here, the worst kind of provincial, face unpowdered and weathered like a peasant's, hair and beard a bristle, uncouth as a monkey and growling a dialect so barbarous that one could barely comprehend him. As for the soldiers in his train, oh, they could almost have been wild folk of Hokkaido. Yes, knowledge of what I leave behind may temper my longing for Heian Kyo. He gave us a few days to make our preparations. Yasuhira hesitated before he said, "Mine will be no fitting existence for a well-born lady. However, if you have nothing else, come with my party. For the rest of our days we can strive to console each other." "I thank you, dear old friend," she answered mutedly. "But I do have my own road before me." He emptied his cup. She refilled it. "Indeed. Let me be glad on your account, not disappointed on mine. Who will take you in?" "No one. I will seek the temple at Higashiyama. That one, for I have often been there with the ex-imperial consort, and the chief priest knows me. I will go and take vows." She had not expected him to show dismay. He almost dropped his cup. Wine slopped forth to stain his outer robe. "What? Do you mean full vows? Become a nun?"
"I think so."
"Cut off your hair, your beautiful hair, don coarse black raiment, live? How will you live?"
"The fiercest bandit dares not harm a nun. The poorest hovel will not deny her shelter and some rice for her bowl. I have in mind to go on perpetual pilgrimage, from shrine to shrine, that I may gain merit in whatever years of this life are left me." Okura smiled. "During those years, perhaps I can call on you from time to time. Then we will remember together." He shook his head, bemused. Like most courtiers, he had never traveled far, seldom more than a day's journey from Heian Kyo, and that had been by carriage, to services that, for his kind, were occasions more social than religious. To view blossoms in the springtime countryside, or the maple leaves of autumn, to admire and make poems about moonlight on Lake Biwa. "Afoot," he mumbled, "roads that wet weather turns into quagmires, mountains, gorges, raging rivers, hunger, rain, snow, wind, fiery sun, ignorant commoners, beasts, demons, ghosts. No." He set down his cup, straightened, firmed his voice. "You shall not. It would be hard for a young man. You, a woman growing old, you will perish miserably. I won't have it." Rather than remind him that he lacked authority over her, for his concern was touching, she asked gently, "Do I seem feeble?" He fell silent. His eyes searched, as if to pierce the garments and look at the body that had sometimes lain beneath his. But no, she thought, that would never cross his mind. A decent man, he found nudity disgusting, and in fact they had always kept on at least one layer of clothing. Finally he murmured, "It is true. It is eerie. The years have scarcely touched you, if at all. You could pass for a woman of 20, but your age is... what? We have known each other for close to 30 years, and you must have been about 20 when you came to court, so that makes you only a little younger than me. And my strength has faded away." "You speak aright," she thought. "Bit by bit I have seen you holding a book farther from your eyes, or blinking at words you do not quite hear. Half your teeth are gone, More and more fevers come upon you, coughs, chills. Do your bones hurt when you rise in the mornings? I know the signs well, and well I should, as often as I have watched them steal over those I loved. The impulse had seized her days before, when the bad news broke, and she began to think what it meant and what to do. She had curbed it, but it stayed restlessly alive. If she yielded, what harm? She could trust this man. She was unsure whether it would help or hinder him against his sorrow. "Let me be honest with him," she decided. "At least it will give him something to think about besides his great loss and the solitude that awaits him." "I am not the age you believe, my dear," she said quietly. "Do you wish the truth? Be warned. At first you may suppose I have gone mad." He studied her before replying with the same softness. "I doubt that. There is more within you than you have ever manifested." I was vaguely but surely conscious of it. Perhaps I dared never inquire. "Then you are wiser than I believed," she thought. Her resolution crystallized. "Let us go outside," she said. "What I have to tell is for no ears but yours." Not troubling about cloaks, they went forth together onto the veranda around this pavilion and along a covered gallery to a kiosk overlooking the pool. Near its placidity rose a man-high stone in whose ruggedness was chiseled the emblem of the clan that had lost this home. Okura halted. "Here is a good spot for me to show you that no evil spirit uses my tongue to speak falsehoods," she said. Solemnly she recited a passage she had chosen from the Lotus Sutra. Yasuhira's manner was as grave when he told her, "Yes, that suffices me." He was of the Amidist sect, which held that the Buddha himself watches over humankind. They stood gazing out at things of chaste beauty. Mist from the rain filled the kiosk and covered hair, clothes, eyelashes, with droplets. The cold and the silence were like presences whose awareness was remote from them. "You suppose I am about 50 years old," she said. "I am more than twice that." He caught a breath, looked sharply at her, looked away, and asked with closely held calm, "How can this be?" "I know not," she sighed. "I know only that I was born in the reign of Emperor Toba, through whom the Fujiwara clan still ruled the realm so strongly that it lay everywhere at peace. I grew up like any other girl of good birth, save that I was never ill. But once I had become fully a woman, all change in me ceased, and thus it has been ever since." "What karma is yours?" he whispered. "I tell you I know not. I have studied, prayed, meditated, practiced austerities, but no enlightenment has come. At last I decided my best course was to continue this long life as well as I was able." "That must be difficult." "It is." "Why have you not revealed yourself?" The voice trembled. "You must be holy, a saint, a bodhisattva." "I know I am not. I am troubled and unsure and tormented by desire, fear, hope, every fleshly evil. Also, as my agelessness first came slowly to notice, I have encountered jealousy, spite, and dread. Yet I could never hitherto bring myself to renounce the world and retreat to a life of sacred poverty. So whatever I am, Miyuki, I am not holy." He pondered. Beyond the garden walls swirled formlessness. Eventually he asked her, "What did you do? What have your years been like?" "When I was 14, an older man, his name no longer matters, sought me out. He being influential, my parents encouraged him. I cared little for him, but knew not how to refuse. In the end, he spent the 3 nights at my side, and thereafter made me a secondary wife. He also got me a position at the court of Toba, who by then had abdicated. I bore him children, 2 of whom lived. Toba died. Soon after, my husband did. By then, the wars between the Taira and the Minamoto had broken out. I made an occasion to retire from the service of Toba's widow, and, taking my inheritance, withdrew to the family from which I sprang. It helped that a lady not at court lives so secluded. But how empty an existence! At last I confided in a lover I had gotten, a man of some wealth and power. He brought me to a rural estate of his, where I spent several years. Meanwhile, he got my daughter married off elsewhere. He took me back to Heian-kyo under her name. Such people as remembered marveled at how much she resembled her mother, and through his patronage I came again into service at a royal household. Gradually I outlived the scorn they have for provincials, but when they gradually observed how I kept my youth— "Do you wish to hear it all?" she asked in an upsurge of weariness. "This has been my third such renewal. The tricks, the deceptions, the children I have borne and, one way or another, managed to have adopted elsewhere, lest it become too plain that they grow old while I do not. That has hurt most. I wonder how much more I could endure." "Therefore you are leaving everything behind," he breathed. The time was already overpast. I hesitated because of the strife, the uncertainty about what would become of my kindred. "Well, that has been settled for me. It feels almost like a liberation. If you take nun's vows, you cannot return here as you did before." "I have no wish to. I have had my fill of the petty intrigues and hollow amusements. Fewer are the midnight stars than the yawns I have smothered, the hours I have stared into vacancy and waited for something, anything, to happen." She touched his hand. "You gave me one reason to linger, but now you too must go. Besides, I wonder how much longer they can keep up the pretense in Heian-kyo. You choose a harder way than I think you imagine. No harder, I think, than most in times to come. It is a cruel age we are bound into. At least a wandering nun has people's respect, and nobody questions her. Some day I may even win to understanding of why we suffer what we do. Could I ever show courage like hers?" he asked the rain. Once more she touched his hand. "I feared this tale might distress you." Still he looked before him into the silvery blindness. "For your sake, perhaps. It has not changed you for me. While I live, you will remain my morning glory. And now you have helped me remember that I am safely mortal. Will you pray for me?" "Always," she promised. They stood a while in silence, then went back inside. There they spoke of happy things and summoned up happy memories, pleasures and lovelinesses that had been theirs. He got a little tipsy. Nevertheless, when they said farewell, it was with the dignity becoming a nobleman and a lady of the imperial court. Chapter 9. Ghosts. Did smoke rouse her? Bitter in her nostrils, sharp-edged in her lungs. At first it was all that was. She coughed. Her skull flew asunder. The shards fell back with a crash. They ground against each other like ice floes on a lake under storm. Again she coughed, and again. Amidst the noise and the sword blade hurt, she began to hear a crackling that loudened. Her eyes opened. The smoke savaged them. Through it, blurrily, she saw the flames. That whole side of the chapel was coming ablaze. Already the fire licked up to the ceiling. She could not make out the saints painted there, nor any icons on the walls. Were they gone? But the altar abided. As the smoke drifted and the half-light leaped, its bulk wavered in her sight. She had a wild, brief sense that it was adrift, would soon reach her and crush her under its weight, or else float away forever on the smoke. Heat billowed. She crept to hands and knees. For a while she could not lift her head. It was too heavy with pain. Then something at the edge of vision drew her in a slow shamble. She slumped above and groped after comprehension. Sister Elena sprawled on her back, very still, more than the altar was, altogether empty of movement. Eyes open, firelight a shimmer in them, mouth agape, tongue half out of it, dry. Legs and loins startlingly white against the clay floor and the habit pulled up over them, white flecks likewise catching the light across her groin. blood spatters bright on thighs and belly. Varvara's insides writhed. She threw up. Once, twice, thrice the vomit burst forth. The surges ripped through her head. When they were done, though, only the foul taste and the burning left in her more awareness had awakened. She wondered in a vague way whether this had been the final violation or a sign of God's grace, covering the traces of what had been done to Elena. "You were my sister in Christ," Barbara thought. "So young, oh, how young! I wish you had not been in such awe of me. Your laughter was sweet to hear. I wish we could sometimes have been together, only the two of us, and told secrets and giggled before we went to prayers. Well, you have won martyrdom, I suppose. Go home to heaven." The words wavered over pain and throbbing and great swoops of dizziness. The fire roared. Its heat thickened. Sparks danced through the smoke. Some landed on her sleeves. They winked out, but she must flee or else burn alive. For a moment, weariness overwhelmed her. Why not die here with little Elena? Make an end of the centuries, now when everything else had come to an end. If she breathed deeply, the agony would be short. Afterward, peace. Sunlight struck long, brass yellow, through haze and whirling soot. While she wondered about death, her body had crawled out the door. Astonishment jolted her more fully back to herself. She swung her gaze to and fro. Nobody was nigh. Mostly wood. The cloister buildings were afire all around. Somehow she got to her feet and stumbled from them. Beyond the enclosure, animal wariness took hold. She crouched back down next to a wall and peered. Monastery and nunnery stood a distance from the town, as was usual. The religious should have found shelter behind the defenses. They had not had time. The Tatars arrived too soon, were there, horses between them and safety. They scrambled back and beseeched the Virgin, the saints, and angels. Presently some of the wild men came to them, yelping like dogs. It made no difference, Varvara saw. Pereyaslavl had fallen. No doubt the Tatars stormed it before they troubled about the house of the Virgin. A monstrous black cloud rose from its walls, up and up into the sky, where it broke apart into smears across eventide purity. Flames stabbed into view beneath. They tinged the gloom with restless red. She remembered dimly how the Lord went before the Israelites as a pillar of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night. Did his voice roar like the pyre that had been Pereyaslavl? Here and there across the rolling farmlands, villages burned too, smaller darknesses taking flight. The Tatars seemed to be assembling near the town. Squads galloped through grain fields toward the main body of horsemen. Warriors afoot herded captives along, not many, but then, Varvara saw, the invaders were no huge army, not the locust swarm of rumor, several hundred, perhaps. They weren't steel-clad, either. It was mostly leather and fur on those stocky forms, now and then a blink, but that was likelier off a weapon than a helmet. One at their van bore the standard, a pole from whose cross-arm hung tails of oxen. The mounts were just ponies, dun-colored, shaggy, long-headed. Yet these men had come as a runaway blaze over the land, driving all before them or trampling it down. Even cloister dwellers had heard years ago how the Pechenegs themselves fled to the Rusi, begging for succor. Riders who attacked like a single dragon with a thousand thunderous legs, arrows that flew like a sleet storm. Otherwise the countryside reached green, outrageously peaceful eastward from the sun. Light streamed into the Trubège so that the river became a flow of gold. Flocks of waterfowl winged toward the marshes along its shores. Yonder is my refuge, Varvara knew, my one tiny hope. How to reach it? Her flesh was a lump of pain, splintered in places with anguish, and her bones were weights. Nevertheless, with the fire at her back, go she must. Knowledge made up for awkwardness. She could advance a bit, freeze, wait till it appeared safe to gain a few more feet. That meant a long time till she reached her goal, but time remained to her. Oh, yes. She choked off a crazy laugh. At first, a cloister orchard gave concealment. How often had these trees blossomed amazing pink and white in spring, rustled green in summer, offered a crisp sweetness in autumn, stood skeletally beautiful against winter's gray for her sisters and her. The number of years was lost somewhere in Varvara's head. Certain of their people flitted through. Elena, shrewish Marina, plump and placid Juliana, Bishop Simeon, grave behind his huge bush of beard, dead today or years since. Ghosts, she herself perhaps dead too, but denied quietness. A Rusalka creeping back to its river. Beyond the orchard was pasture. Varvara thought for a while she would do best to wait among the trees for nightfall. Terror whipped her onward. She found herself slipping along more and more snakishly. Skill returned. Indeed it did, when you had gained it in your girlhood. Before Christ came to the Rusi, and for generations afterward, women often ranged the forest as freely as men. Not the deep forest, no, it was dark, trackless, a place where beasts and demons prowled, but the verge, where sunlight reached and you could gather nuts and berries. That lost greenwood felt closer than the cloister. She had no recollection of what happened after the enemy drew near the sanctuary. At a sudden thudding, she went flat in the grass. Despite utter weariness, her heart banged, and a thin singing lifted between her temples. It was well she had not stayed in the orchard. Several totter horses trotted among the trees and out onto the slope. She glimpsed one rider clearly, his broad brown face, slant-slit eyes, wispy whiskers. Did she know him? Had he known her back in the chapel? They passed close by, but onward. They had not noticed her. Thanks welled in her breast. Only later did she recall that they had not been to God or any saint, but to Daj Bog of the Sun, the Protector. Another ancient memory, another strong ghost. Dusk softened horizons by the time she reached the marsh for which she aimed. Fitful reddening still touched the smoke of Pereyaslavl. The outlying villages must be entirely ash and charcoal. Potter campfires began to twinkle in ordered clusters. They were small like their masters, and bloody. Mud oozed cool over Varvara's sandals, between her toes, up her ankles. She found a hummock where the grass was merely damp and sank down, curled onto its springiness. Her fingers dug into the turf and the sod beneath. Earth, mother of all, hold me close. Never let me go. Comfort your child. The first stars glimmered forth. She grew able to weep. Thereafter she pulled off her clothes, layer by layer. A breeze nuzzled her nakedness. Having left the garments bundled, she pushed through reeds till she waded in the stream. Here she could wash out her mouth and gullet. Drink and drink. The water was slow to reach every parched finger end. Meanwhile, she crouched and scrubbed herself over and over. The river laved, licked, caressed. She squatted and opened her loins to it. Make me clean, she begged. Light of stars and the heaven path gleamed off its current, enough for her to find her way back. She stood on the hummock so the breeze could dry her. That made her shiver, but didn't take long. Her lips quirked for a moment. Cropped hair was a legacy of the cloister, useful tonight. Afterward, she took up her clothes and nearly retched. Now she caught their stench of sweat, blood, totter. It took almost the last of her strength to put them back on. Maybe she couldn't have, were it not for the overlay of smoke smell. Another legacy, another remembrance. She must keep covered against the night chill. Though she had never been sick in her life, she might well be too weakened to stave off a fever. Slumping back onto the hummock, she dropped into a half-sleep wherein ghosts gibbered. Dawn roused her. She sneezed, groaned, shuddered. However, as brightness lengthened across the land, the same cold clarity waxed within. Cautiously, moving about her hiding place, she felt the stiffness work out of her joints, the aches dwindle. Wounds still hurt, but lessening as day warmed them. She knew they would heal.
She kept well down amidst the reeds, but from time to time ventured to look outward. She saw the Tatars water their horses, but the river blotted up any filth before it reached her. She saw them ride from horizon to horizon. Often they returned with burdens, loot. When the shifting masses at camp chanced to part before her eyes, she spied the captives huddled together under mounted guard. Boys and young women, she supposed, those worth taking for slaves. The rest lay dead in the ashes. She still lacked memory of her last hours in the cloister. A blow to the head could do that. She had no wish for the knowledge. Imagination served. When the raiders broke in, the religious must have scattered. Quite likely, Varvara seized Elena's hand and led her, a dash into the chapel of St. Eudoxia. It was small and offside, without treasures. The devils might overlook it. Of course they hadn't. But what then? How had Elena died? Varvara, well, she dared hope she had fought, forced three or four to hold her down by turns. She was big, strong, a survivor of much, used to looking after herself. At last, she guessed, a Tatar, maybe when she bit him, smashed her head against the floor. Elena, though. Elena was slight and frail, gentle, dreamy. She could only have lain where she was while the thing went on and on and on. Maybe the last man, seeing what his fellow did to punish Varvara, had grinned and done the same to Elena. It killed her. Did they take her companion for dead also, belt up their breeches and go? Or did they simply not care? At least they hadn't used knives. Varvara would not have outlived that. Indeed, while her skull seemed amply hard, she might not have roused in time to escape, save for the vitality that kept her ageless. She should thank God for it. No, she breathed. First, I thank you for letting Elena die. She would have been broken, haunted all her days, hounded all her nights. Further gratitude slipped her mind. The river and the hours muttered past. Birds clamored. Flies buzzed thick as smoke, drawn by her stinking garb. Hunger began to gnaw. She recollected another old skill. Lay belly down in the mud by a backwater that some drifted brushwood had formed. Waited. She was no longer alone. Ghosts crowded close. They touched and tugged at her, whispered, beckoned. At first they were horrible. They took her against her will. Drunken husbands and two different ruffians who had caught her during the years when she wandered. With a third, she had been lucky and gotten the knife into him first. "Burn in hell with those Tatars," she snarled. "I outlived you. I shall outlive them." Yes, and the memories of them. If nothing else, she would humble the new ghosts as she had overcome the old ones. It might take years. She had years. But at last the strength that had kept her alive this long would again make her able to live gladly. "Good men, come back to me. I miss you. We were happy together, were we not? Father, white-bearded grandfather from whom she could wheedle anything, elder brother Bogdan, how they used to fight, but how splendid he later grew, before a sickness ravaged his guts and tore him down. Younger brother, yes, and sisters, who teased her and became dear to her. Neighbors. Dur, who kissed her so shyly in a clover meadow where bees buzzed. She was 12 years old, and the world wobbled. Vladimir, first of her husbands, a strong man until age gnawed him hollow, but always gentle with her. Husbands later, those she had liked. Friends who stood by her, priests who consoled her when sorrow returned to her house. How well she recalled ugly little Gleb Ilyev. But then, he was the first of those who helped her escape when a home turned into a trap. Oh, and her sons, grandsons, daughters and granddaughters too, great-grandchildren. But time took them away. Every ghost had a face that changed, grew old, finally was the mask that the dead wear. No, not quite everyone. Some she had known too fleetingly. Strange how vivid remained that trader from abroad, Cadog, his name. Yes, Cadog. She was glad she had not watched him crumble. When?
200 years, more or less, since their night in Kiev. Of course, he might have perished early in the beauty of his youth. Others were misty. Certain among them she was unsure of, whether they had been real or were fragments of dreams that had clung to memory. With a splash and splatter, a frog jumped from among the rushes onto the brushwood. He settled himself, fat, green-white, to lurk for flies. Varvara stayed moveless. She saw his attention turn from where she lay. Her hand pounced. He struggled, cool and slippery, till she knocked him on the head. Then she plucked him apart, gnawed and sucked his meat off the bones, cast them into the river with muttered thanks. Ducks bobbed in midstream. She could have shed her clothes, slid into the water, swum carefully underneath to seize one by the legs. But no, the Tatars might glimpse it. Instead, she grubbed sedges of a kind with edible roots. Yes, the forest skills lived on in her, had never really faded. Otherwise, she supposed it was a growing despair, a sense of her soul slipping from her that brought her to the sanctuary. No, that wasn't the whole reason. She had said too many farewells. In the house of God was refuge that would endure. Surely there was peace around her, if not always within. The lusts of the flesh refused to die. Among them, the wish to feel again a small warmth in her arms, a small mouth milking her. She reined them in, but then sometimes they kicked up mockeries of the faith, memories of old earthy gods, longings to see beyond walls and fare beyond horizons. And petty sins, too, anger at her sisters, impatience with the priests and the endlessly same tasks. Nonetheless, on the whole, peace. Between the chores, the chafings, and the puzzled search for sanctity were hours in which she could, bit by bit, year by year, rebuild herself. She discovered how to order memories, have them at her beck rather than let them fade to nothing, or else overwhelm her with their manyness. She tamed her ghosts. A wind made the sedges rustle. She shivered likewise. What if she had failed? If she was not alone in the world, was the common fate of her kind to go mindless and perish helpless? Or was she in truth alone, whether blessed or damned? Certainly the cloister had no record of such folk ever, since the Methuselan morning of the world. Not that she had told anybody beforehand. The caution of centuries forbade. She came as a widow, taking the veil because the church encouraged widows to do so. To be sure, when the decades slipped by and her flesh continued young. Noise thrust into the marsh, shouts, whinnies, drumbeats. She scuttered to look. The Tatars had trussed up their loot and marshaled their ranks. They were departing. She saw no captives, but guessed they were bound astride pack horses with the rest of the baggage. Smoke still blew thinly out of the blackened, broken walls of Pereyaslavl. The Tatars were headed northeasterly, away from the Trubezh, toward the Dnieper and the Kiev. The great city was a day's march in that direction, less on horseback. Oh, Christ have mercy! Were they off to take Kiev? No, they were too few. But others must be raging elsewhere across the Russian land. Their demon king must have a plan. They could join together, resharpen swords blunted by butchery, and go on as a conquering horde. In the house of God I sought eternity, passed through Varvara. Here I have seen that it also has an end. I too? Yes, I can die, if only by steel or fire or famine or flood. Therefore some day I shall die. Already to those among whom I was ageless, those that live, I am a ghost, or less than a ghost. First the nuns, later the monks and secular priests, finally the layfolk began to marvel at Sister Varvara. After some 50 years, peasants were appealing to her for help in their woes, and pilgrims arriving from places quite far. As she had feared from the outset, there was no choice but to tell her confessor the truth about her past. With her reluctant leave, he informed Bishop Simeon. The latter planned to inform the Metropolitan. If they did not have an actual saint in the cloister of the Virgin, and Sister Varvara said she could not possibly be one, they had a miracle.
How was she to live with that? She would never have to. The bishop, the priests, the believers were dead or fled. The annals of the cloister were burned. Anything elsewhere was likewise destroyed, or soon would be, or was doomed to molder away forgotten now when people had so much death to think about. A memory of her might linger in a few minds, but seldom find utterance, and it would die with them. Had the Totters come as God's denial, his decision that she was unworthy, or as his release from a burden no child of Adam should bear, or was she, defiled and torn, nonetheless so full of worldly pride that she dared imagine she mattered? She clung to the hummock. Earth and sun, moon and stars, wind and rain and human love, she could understand the old gods better than she understood Christ. But they were forsaken by man, remembered only in dances and feasts, fireside tales and fireside spirits. They were ghosts. Yet lightning, thunder, and vengeance forever walked the skies above Russia, be they of Perun or of St. Yuri the Dragon Slayer. Vavra drank strength from the soil as a babe drinks milk. When the Totters were out of sight, she sprang to her feet, shook her fist after them, and shouted, "We will abide! We will outlast you, and in the end we will crush you and take back what is ours!" Calmer then, she removed her clothes, washed them in the river, spread them on a slope to dry. Meanwhile she cleansed herself again and gathered more wild food. Next morning she sought the ruins. Ash, charred timber, snags of brick and stone lay silent under heaven. A pair of churches were left, foul with soot. Inside them sprawled corpses. The slain outside were many more, and in worse condition. Carrion birds quarreled over them, flying off with a blast of wingbeats and shrieks whenever she approached. There was nothing she could do but offer a prayer. Searching about, she found clothes, shoes, an undamaged knife, and such like needs. Taking each, she smiled and whispered, "Thank you," to its owner's ghost. Her journey would be hard and dangerous at best. She did not mean it to end until she had reached the kind of new home she wanted, whatever that was. In the dawn that followed, before setting forth, she told the sky, "Remember my name. I am Varvara no more. I am again Svoboda, freedom." Chapter 10. In the Hills. 1. Where mountains began their long climb toward Tibet, a village nestled. On three sides its dell lifted steeply, making horizons high and close. A stream from the west rushed through upper woods of cypress and dwarf oak, gleamed as a waterfall, passed among the buildings, and lost itself in bamboo and ruggedness eastward. The people cultivated wheat, soybeans, vegetables, melons, some fruit trees on the floor of the vale, and on small terraces above. They kept pigs, chickens, and a fish pond. This, their score or so of turf-roofed earthen houses, and they themselves had been there so long that sun, rain, snow, wind, and time had made them as much a part of the land as the pheasant, the panda, or the wildflowers in spring. On the east the view opened, a wrinklescape manifoldly green and tawny with forest, to right and left a sight of snow peaks afloat in heaven. Through it wound a road, scarcely more than a track, the village its terminus. Traffic was sparse. Several times a year men undertook a journey of days to market in a little town and home again. There they also paid taxes in kind. Thus the governor very seldom thought to send a man to them. When he did, the inspector only stayed overnight, inquired of the elders how things were going, received ritual answers, and departed eagerly. The place had a somewhat uncanny reputation. That was in the eyes of orthodox outsiders. To others it was holy. Because of this awe, whether vague or devout, as well as its loneliness, war and banditry had passed the village by. It followed its own ways, enduring no more than the ordinary sorrows and calamities of life. Once in a while a pilgrim overcame the obstacles, distance, hardship, danger, to visit it. In the course of generations, a few among those had remained.
the village took them into its peace. Thus things were. Thus had they always been. Their beginnings were unknown save to myth and the master. Great, therefore, was the excitement when a herd-boy came running and shrilled that a traveller was on the way. "Shame, bad, that you left your ox unattended," chided his grandfather, but gently. The boy explained that he had first tethered the beast, and after all no tiger arrived. He was forgiven. Meanwhile folk bustled and shouted about. Presently a disciple struck the gong in the shrine. A metal voice toned forth, rang off the hillsides, mingled with shush of waterfall and murmur of wind. Autumn comes early in the high hills. Woodlands were dappled brown and yellow, grass was turning sere, fallen leaves crunched underfoot near puddles left by last night's rain. Overhead the sky arched, unutterably blue, empty of all but wings. Bird cries drifted faint through air flowing down the mountainside. Smoke from hearth fires sharpened its chill. As the strangers trudged up the last stretch of road, the gathered villagers saw with astonishment that this was a woman. Threadbare and oft mended, her gown of coarse cotton had faded to gray. Her boots were equally near the end of their service, and use had worn smooth the staff that swung in her right hand. From her left shoulder hung a rolled-up blanket, just as way-worn, which held a wooden bowl and perhaps one or two other things. Yet she was no beggar, Granny. Her body was straight and slim, her stride firm and limber. Where a scarf fluttered loose, one could see hair like a crow's wing, hacked off just below the earlobes, and her face, though weathered, drawn close over the bones, was unlined. Never had such a face appeared in these parts. She did not even seem of quite the same breed as the lowlanders from whose country she fared. Eldred Song trod forward. For lack of a better thought, he greeted her according to the ancient rite, despite every newcomer hitherto having been male. "In the name of the master and the people, I bid you welcome to our morning dew village. May you walk in the Dao in peace, and the gods and spirits walk with you. May the hour of your advent prove lucky. Enter as a guest, depart as a friend." "This humble person thanks you, honorable sir," she replied. Her accent was like none that anybody had heard before, but that was no surprise. "I come in search of enlightenment." The word shook. Fervent must her hope be. Song turned and bowed toward the shrine and the master's house behind it. "Here is the home of the way," he said. Some person smiled smugly. "Their home." "May we know your name, that it be borne to the master?" Song asked. She hesitated, then, "I call myself Lee, honorable sir." He nodded. The wind ruffled his thin white beard. "If you have chosen that, you have likely chosen well." In her pronunciation it could mean the measure of distance. Ignoring whispers, mutters, and stirrings among the folk, he forbore to inquire further. "Come, you shall take refreshment and stay with me." "Your leader." "In due course, young miss, in due course. Pray come." Her features settled into an aspect no one could fathom, something between resignation and an ageless determination. "Again, my humble thanks," she said, and accompanied him. The villagers moved aside. Several uttered words of goodwill. Beneath a natural curiosity, they were as alike in their mildness, the very children were, as in their padded garments and work-hardened hands. Alike, too, were many faces, broad and rather flat-nosed above sturdy frames. After Song, his family, and Lee disappeared, they chatted for a while, then piecemeal went back to their cook-fires, handmills, looms, tools, animals, all that kept them alive as it had kept their ancestors alive from time out of mind. Song's oldest son, with wife and offspring, lived with him. They stayed in the background, except for serving tea and food. The house was larger than most. Four rooms inside rammed earth walls, darksome but comfortably warm. While homes were poorly and rudely furnished, there was no real want. Rather, contentment and cheerfulness prevailed.
Song and Lee sat on mats at a low table and enjoyed broth flavored with ruddy peppercorns, fragrant amidst the savors of other foodstuffs hung under the roof. "You shall wash and rest before we meet with my fellow elders," he promised. Her spoon trembled. "Please," she blurted, "when may I see the teacher? I have come a long and weary way." Song frowned. "I understand your desire, but we really know nothing about you, Miss Lee." Her lashes lowered. "Forgive me. I think what I have to tell is for his ears alone, and I think, I pray he will want to hear me soon. Soon." "We must not be over hasty. That would be irreverent, and maybe unlucky. What do you know about him?" "Hardly more than rumors, I confess. The story, no, different stories in different places as I wandered. At first they sounded like folk tales. A holy man afar in the west, so holy that death dares not touch him. Only as I came nearer did anyone tell me that this is his dwelling ground. Few would say that much. They seemed afraid to speak, although I never heard ill of him." "No ill is there to hear," said Song, softened by her earnestness. "You must have a great soul that you ventured the pilgrimage. Quite alone, too, a youthful woman. Surely your stars are strong that you took no harm. That bodes well." Dim of eye, and in smoky dusk, he failed to see how she winced. "Nevertheless, our wizard must read the bones," he continued thoughtfully, "and we must offer to the ancestors and spirits, yes, hold a purification, for you are a woman." "What has the holy man to fear if time itself obeys him?" she cried. His tone calmed her somewhat. "Nothing, I dare say, and certainly he will protect us, his beloved people, as he always has. What do you wish to hear about him?" "Everything, everything," she whispered. Song smiled. His few stumps of teeth glistened in what light passed through a tiny window. "That would take years," he said. "He has been with us for centuries, if not longer." Again she tautened. "When did he come?" Song sipped his tea. "Who knows? He has books. He can read and write. But the rest of us cannot. We tally the months, but not the years. Why should we? Under his good sway, life spans are alike, as happy as the stars and the spirits may grant. The outside world troubles us never. Wars, famines, pestilences, those are not buzz borne in from the market town, which itself hears little. I could not tell you who reigns in Nanking these days, nor do I care. The Ming drove out the foreign yuan some 200 years ago, and the imperial seat is Peking." "Ah, learned, are you?" the old man chuckled. "Yes, our forebears did hear about invaders from the north, and we know they are now gone. However, the Tibetans are much closer, and they have not attacked these parts for generations, nor ever our village. Thanks be to the master." "He is your true king, then?" "No, no," the bald head shook. "To rule over us would be beneath his dignity. He counsels the elders when we ask, and of course we heed. He instructs us, during our childhoods and throughout our lives, in the way. And of course we gladly follow it as well as we are able. When someone falls from it, the chastisement he orders is gentle, though quite enough, since real evil-doing means expulsion, exile, homelessness for life and ever afterward." Song shuddered slightly before going on. "He receives pilgrims. From among them and from among our own youths who wish it, he accepts a few disciples at a time. They serve his worldly needs, listen to his wisdom, strive to attain a small part of his holiness. Not that this keeps them from eventually having households of their own. And often the master honors a family, any family in the village, with his presence or his blood." "His blood?" Lee flushed when Song answered. "You have much to learn, young miss.
Male yang and female yin must join for the health of the body, the soul, and the world. I am myself a grandson of the master. Two daughters of mine have borne him children. One was already married, but her husband kept from her until they were sure it would indeed be a child of Dushan that blessed their home. The second, who was lame in one leg, suddenly needed only a bedspread for her dowry. Thus is the way.
I see. He could barely hear her. She had gone pale.
If you cannot accept this, he said kindly, you may still meet him and receive his blessing before you leave. He forces no one.
She gripped the spoon in her fist as if its handle were a post to which she clung, lest she be whirled off the earth.
No, I will surely do his will,
stumbled from her throat.
I who have been seeking over all these li, all these years.
2. He could have been a peasant man of the village, but then every one of them was closely or distantly descended from him. With the same strong frame, clad in the same thick coat and trousers, the same grime and calluses on feet that indoors were bare. His beard hung thin, youthfully black. His hair was drawn into a topknot. The house he inhabited with his disciples was as big as any, but no bigger. Also of plain earth above a clay floor. The room to which one of the young men admitted her before bowing and leaving was scarcely better furnished. There was a bedstead, wide enough for him and whatever woman might attend him, straw mats, stools, table, a calligraphic scroll gone brown-spotted and fly-specked on the wall above a stone altar, a wooden chest for clothing, a smaller brass one that doubtless held books, a few bowls, cups, cloths, and other everyday things. The window was shuttered against a blustery wind. A single lamp flame did little to relieve murkiness. Coming in from outdoors, Lee was first aware of the smell. It was not unpleasant, but it was heavy, blent of old smoke and grease, manure tracked in on shoes, humanity, centuries. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.